Usually, when we think about monumental human achievements, we picture giant laboratories or, I don't know, massive equations.
Right, like highly explosive rocket fuel and all that noise.
Exactly. We tend to equate power with fire and noise. It's loud and it's super visible. But then you look at one of the most transformative technologies in human history, the thing that literally connected the continents.
And built global empires.
Yeah, and it's completely silent. I mean, it runs entirely on an invisible force.
It's wild to think about. You step outside, a gust of wind hits you, and somehow our ancestors figured out how to turn that mild environmental phenomenon into a massive global transportation network.
Which is exactly why today we're jumping into a huge stack of sources for this deep dive. We've got a comprehensive overview detailing the history, the evolution, and honestly, the genuinely mind-bending physics of sailing.
Because the goal here is to really explore how humanity learned to harness wind propulsion to conquer the globe,
Right.
and how a critical survival technology eventually morphed into the high-performance sport we see today.
We're tracking a journey from ancient Egyptian rivers all the way to the counterintuitive physics of aerodynamic wings that operate completely underwater.
But before we can understand the mechanics of modern racing boats, the ones that are practically flying above the water, we really have to look back at how early humans first cracked the code of wind propulsion.
Which didn't happen all at once, right?
Exactly. The sources indicate that sailing wasn't a single eureka moment in one specific location. It was independently invented in at least two totally different
What
regions.
way?
Yeah, first in the Mediterranean and Middle Eastern rivers, and then completely separately in inland Southeast Asia.
Okay, let's unpack this because the geography itself essentially acted as like a training wheel setup for early navigators.
That's a great way to put it.
The Nile River, right around 3100 BCE, is the ultimate example of this. The river's current naturally flows from south to north, but the prevailing wind in that region blows from north to south.
What's fascinating here is how it creates a naturally occurring two-way highway.
Just a total geographic freebie.
Exactly. You just float your vessel in the current to go north, which is an unobstructed trip of hundreds of miles. And then when you need to return, you hoist a primitive sail and let the prevailing wind push you back south against the current.
It's as if the Earth was begging us to invent the sail.
Seriously, the environment provided an incredibly forgiving nursery for early maritime experimentation.
But while the West was, floating up and down a relatively safe river, you have the Austronesian expansions starting around 3000 BCE.
Which is a completely different ball game.
Completely different. These people expanded from southern China and Taiwan into the islands of maritime Southeast Asia, Micronesia, Polynesia, and eventually all the way to Madagascar.
And their technology had zero commonality with Western or even Chinese boats.
Right. They were building outriggers, catamarans, and these highly distinctive crab claw sails.
They were also navigating vast stretches of open ocean using stick charts to read wave swells, which is just incredible.
It is. But the true genius of the Austronesian expansion was their fundamental exploration strategy. They built craft specifically capable of sailing upwind.
Yeah, that was the game changer.
I look at that upwind capability as the ultimate historical cheat code. When they set out to explore the unknown expanse of the Pacific, they would deliberately sail against the prevailing winds.
Right, which sounds counterintuitive until you realize why.
Exactly. If they discovered a new island, perfect.
Yeah.
But if they found nothing, or if their supplies started running low, they had built-in risk management. They could just turn the boat around and have a guaranteed, incredibly fast downwind ride straight back home to safety.
And what's fascinating here is that they mastered that survival architecture purely through observation and feel. I mean, thousands of years before the mathematics of fluid dynamics even existed.
Just feeling the wind and the wave.
Exactly. And once human societies internalized these mechanics, the economic implications fundamentally restructured the world. The Roman Empire gives us a stunning data point on this.
Oh, the grain trade data.
Yeah, during the classical period, Rome was consuming about 150,000 tons of Egyptian grain every single year.
That scale is just hard to wrap your head around for the ancient world.
Yeah.
150,000 tons.
And the economics of moving it are even wilder.
Yeah, according to the historical data in our sources, it costs less for a Roman sailing ship to carry grain 1,126 nautical miles across the entire Mediterranean Sea.
Than it did to move it over land, right?
Yes, than to move that exact same cargo just 15 miles over land by wagon.
Wow. So water transport, powered by a completely free energy source, became the undisputed king of global logistics for millennia.
It dictated the growth of the modern world.
Totally. Even fast-forwarding to the industrial era, the sheer volume of maritime traffic is staggering. The coal trade from the River Tyne to London required 4,395 sailing cargoes in the year 1795 alone.
1795. That's a lot of boats.
Sailing was literally the heavy industrial backbone of the planet.
But the evolution of the vessels themselves tells a fascinating story about shifting human priorities, too. In ancient times, the heavy merchant vessels were powered by sail, but naval power-like, the actual warships, were galleys.
Right, or powered ships like the biremes and triremes.
Yeah. Their entire operational purpose was just to be a delivery system for hand-to-hand combat. They would ram into each other, and soldiers would literally jump across the decks.
And they relied on human oarsmen because they needed sudden bursts of speed and precise maneuverability in battle. Early square sails just couldn't provide that.
Right. And that dynamic didn't really change until around the year 1500, when structural innovations allowed sailing vessels to mount heavy broadside cannons through gun ports.
This is a huge turning point.
Massive. That single technological leap shifted naval warfare entirely. It moved from ramming tactics to forming a line of battle, completely revolutionizing global power dynamics.
Making the heavily armed sailing ship the ultimate geopolitical weapon.
Exactly. But the absolute peak of raw sailing performance was arguably in commerce, specifically the 19th century Baltimore Clippers.
Oh, these were incredible machines.
You're looking at ships with masts 100 feet high, designed with incredibly fine lines to move high-value, time-sensitive cargo-like tea from China as fast as humanly possible.
They were just built for pure speed.
The Clippers could hit 19 knots, which is about 35 kilometers an hour, covering up to 465 nautical miles in a single day.
And they were doing that using nothing but wind. I mean, yeah. Iron-hulled sailing ships actually dominated the bulk cargo trade right up to the end of the 19th century.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because that brings up a massive historical misconception.
About steamships?
Yeah. We tend to assume the steam engine came along and simply blew sailing ships out of the water with raw speed and power. But the early steamships were sluggish.
Really sluggish.
They could barely make 8 knots. Meanwhile, the Clippers are flying past them at 19 knots. Plus, the sailing ships didn't have to stop every few days for fresh water for the boilers.
Or waste half their precious cargo capacity storing giant piles of coal just to burn.
Exactly.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the transition away from wind wasn't about speed at all. It was entirely about supply chain predictability.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
Yeah, the wind is a free energy source, sure, but it has no respect for a quarterly earnings report. Ship-owning investors required guaranteed return schedules on their massive capital investments.
So a steamship might be slower on a good day, but it could run on a strict timetable.
Precisely. Plus, steamships could take much shorter, more direct routes. They could motor straight through the doldrums where sailing ships would just sit stranded.
Right.
And eventually, they could pass through the Suez and Panama canals, which sailing ships really struggled to navigate effectively because of the narrow confines and fluky winds.
That predictable timetable is what finally rendered commercial sailing uneconomical. It pushed the practice out of global logistics and transitioned it firmly into the realm of modern recreation, passion, and high-tech sport.
Which is a fascinating pivot.
It is. Because now that sailing is freed from the constraints of hauling heavy cargo, the boats are faster and aerodynamically cleaner than anything the ancient world could have dreamed of.
Oh, absolutely.
But for anyone standing on the shore watching a modern boat slice through the water, the actual mechanics of how they move are deeply counterintuitive, especially when the wind isn't pushing them from behind.
Yeah, the physics of the modern sail operate in two fundamentally different modes, what aerodynamicists call parachute mode and wing mode.
Okay, so parachute mode is the intuitive one. You are sailing downwind, the wind is behind you, and the sail is literally just catching the air.
Right, catching it like a bag.
Yeah, the airflow is detached, swirling around in turbulent eddies in front of the sail, and the dominant force moving the boat is just plain drag.
But parachute mode is actually the highly inefficient way to sail. The true speed and power happen in wing mode when a boat is sailing close to the wind.
Moving into the wind.
Exactly. In this mode, airflow remains attached to both sides of the sail, and the fabric acts identically to an airplane wing standing vertically. It generates lift.
So the boat is being pulled forward by a pressure gradient rather than being pushed.
Yes. As the air follows the curved path along the leeward side of the sail, that's the backside curving away from the wind, the air accelerates, which drops the pressure.
And the windward side has relatively higher pressure.
Right, and the sail naturally wants to move toward the lower pressure, generating a massive lifting force perpendicular to the wind direction.
And because of that aerodynamic lift, the wind the sailors actually feel on their faces isn't the true wind that's blowing across the water. The sails operate entirely on a concept called apparent wind.
Apparent wind is crucial to understand here.
So what does this all mean? The apparent wind is the combination of the true wind, like what a stationary flag on a beach would show, and the wind created by the boat's own forward velocity.
It's real.
The best way to visualize this is sticking your hand out the window of a moving car on a totally windless day.
Yeah.
You feel a massive rush of air hitting your hand simply because of your forward speed.
Right.
On a sailboat, you take the true wind hitting the side of the boat, add the wind you were generating by moving forward, and combine those two vectors.
Mm.
That resultant angle and speed is your apparent wind.
And that combination is the actual motive power the sails consume. The faster the hull cuts through the water, the more extreme that vector calculation becomes. Take ice boats, for example.
Oh, ice boats are crazy.
They really are. Because they run on skate runners over pure ice, they experience virtually zero forward hydrodynamic resistance.
So they accelerate so rapidly that their own forward velocity completely dwarfs the true wind speed.
Exactly. Because they're creating so much of their own wind, their apparent wind shifts drastically forward. It's almost always coming from the very front of the ice boat, regardless of which way the true wind is blowing across the lake.
Which means, because of that forward apparent wind, their sails have to be sheeted in tightly, like pulled securely to the center line of the boat on almost every single point of sail.
Just to maintain that narrow, wing-like angle of attack.
They're moving so fast, they essentially drag the wind around to the nose of the vehicle.
It's amazing. And traditional sailboats on the water are chasing this exact same aerodynamic efficiency. They use multiple sails to optimize the lift, typically a jib in the front and a mainsail in the back.
But wait, putting a second sail right in front of the mainsail seems like it would just block the wind.
It seems like it would, right. But it actually creates a highly engineered interaction known as the slot effect. The jib doesn't block the air. It funnels and accelerates high-speed air straight into the leeward, low-pressure side of the mainsail.
So it's injecting kinetic energy into the boundary layer of the mainsail.
Exactly. By speeding up the air traveling over the back of the mainsail, the slot effect prevents the airflow from detaching and stalling. Yeah, it flattens out the pressure gradient, allowing the mainsail to operate at a much higher angle of attack without losing its lift. It's a beautifully tuned aerodynamic system that has to survive in a pretty chaotic environment. Take wind shear, for instance.
Right, because the friction of the water's surface physically drags on the air, slowing it down.
Yes.
So a breeze that feels like 10 knots to a crew member sitting on the deck might be blowing at 15 knots at the top of a tall mast.
Exactly. The higher you go up the mast, the stronger the true wind becomes. And because the true wind is stronger up high, but the boat's forward speed remains constant, the apparent wind vector changes.
It changes at different heights.
Yeah, the apparent wind angle actually shifts further aft toward the back of the boat, the higher up the sail you measure it.
That's wild. The wind is literally hitting the bottom of the sail from an entirely different angle than it's hitting the top of the sail.
Which means sailors have to physically induce a twist into the shape of the sail, letting the top section fall away slightly to keep the airflow perfectly attached from the deck all the way to the top of the mast.
Add to that the fact that atmospheric physics dictate wind gusts are routinely 1.5 times stronger than the prevailing wind.
You are constantly trimming a giant fabric wing that is generating massive amounts of lateral lift while getting slammed by unpredictable gusts.
Which brings us to the crucial transition from aerodynamics in the sky down to hydrodynamics in the water.
The real balancing act.
Right. Because if that sail is generating all its lift essentially perpendicular to the wind, pulling the boat sideways, why doesn't the boat just slide laterally across the ocean or immediately flip over?
Well, the hull has to aggressively fight back. First, there is a fundamental limitation. Conventional sailing craft cannot sail directly into the wind.
Right, the no-go zone.
Yeah, usually an arc of about 45 degrees on either side of the true wind direction, where the sails simply flap and cannot generate an effective angle of attack.
So to get to a destination directly upwind, you have to zigzag. You sail 45 degrees to the right, then tack the boat, and sail 45 degrees to the left.
Precisely. But during all of this, when the sail is violently pulling the boat to the side, the underwater appendages do the real heavy lifting.
The keel, the centerboard, or the daggerboard?
Yes. And these aren't just heavy pendulums dragging in the water to keep the boat upright. They are highly engineered underwater wings.
It's basically an airplane wing turned vertically in the water, generating horizontal lift.
Exactly. Just as the sail presents an angle of attack to the wind in the sky to generate aerodynamic lift, the keel presents a slight angle of attack, usually just a few degrees of slip to the water passing by.
And because water is so dense, the fluid dynamics of the water flowing over the keel generate a powerful hydrodynamic lift that directly opposes the sideways pulling force of the sail.
You have a force high up in the air pushing left and a force deep in the water pushing right. They cancel out the lateral movement, leaving forward momentum as the only available avenue for all that energy to escape.
But those two massively opposing forces, separated by the height of the mast and the depth of the keel, create a massive rotational force, a heeling moment.
The boat is desperate to lean over and capsize.
Yeah, you see these racing yachts tipped over at terrifying angles.
They stay upright through a combination of ballast and form stability. The keel is packed with thousands of pounds of heavy lead ballast at the very bottom.
So it's basically a lever.
Right. The further the boat heels over, the more rotational leverage that lead weight has to pull the mast back upright. Alternatively, you have catamarans, which rely entirely on form stability, a massively wide stance on two hulls rather than a heavy lead weight, to resist the rotational force of the sails.
Okay, I have to ask about a critical bottleneck in all this physics, though.
Go for it.
If the sail is your engine generating lift in the air, and the keel is generating opposite lift in the water, what is actually stopping a boat from accelerating infinitely? Like, if you take a standard 30-foot boat and bolt a 100-foot mast and sail onto it, why doesn't it just tear through the water at 40 knots?
This raises an important question, and it runs directly into the brutal physics of the hull speed limit.
It's hull speed. Oh, okay.
When a standard displacement hull moves through the ocean, it has to physically displace the water out of its way, which creates a bow wave. As the boat accelerates, the wavelength of that bow wave stretches out and gets longer.
Ah, so the distance between the crest at the front of the boat and the crest at the back of the boat gets wider.
Exactly. And eventually, the wavelength of that bow wave perfectly matches the waterline length of the boat itself.
Okay, and what happens then?
At this exact velocity, the boat becomes trapped in a trough of its own making. The bow is riding up the back of the front wave, and the stern is sinking into the trough.
So if a massive gust of wind hits you right at that moment, injecting huge amounts of energy into the sails, you don't actually accelerate.
Nope. The wave doesn't move forward faster. It just gets steeper. The boat is literally forced to try and climb uphill over its own bow wave.
That sounds exhausting.
It is. It requires an astronomical exponential increase in power just to gain a fraction of a knot in speed. You aren't going faster, you're just pushing a larger, steeper wall of water through the ocean.
You're burning all that aerodynamic energy just to churn water.
Unless you figure out how to cheat the system.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what modern planing and foiling boats do.
Right, the ones that fly.
Yeah, they are engineered with flat bottoms or underwater hydrofoils to physically lift the hull completely out of the water. They skim over the top of their own bow wave, completely bypassing the hull's speed limit and decoupling from the drag of the water.
Wow. When you watch a modern sailing machine heeling over intensely, balancing on a single hydrofoil and slicing through the water at 50 knots, it's just a breathtaking sight.
It really is. It isn't falling. It is existing in a state of perfectly balanced dynamic equilibrium between aerodynamic forces in the sky trying to rip it over and hydrodynamic forces in the water locking it in place.
We've tracked an incredible evolution today. I mean, we started on the ancient currents of the Nile and looked at the Austronesian navigators who used upwind geometry to discover entirely new worlds.
Worlds they couldn't have reached otherwise.
Exactly. Then we watched the industrial transition, where the reliable timetable of the steam engine replaced the raw wind-powered speed of the commercial clippers.
Shifting the whole paradigm of trade.
And finally, we unpacked the invisible mechanics operating right in front of us. Pressure gradients, apparent wind vectors, the slot effect, and the epic battle between hull speed and lateral resistance.
It's a vast amount of physics that we've codified into hard mathematics over the last few centuries, but the truly remarkable part of this entire technological arc is the timeline.
Yeah, think about when this all started.
The Austronesians mapped the largest ocean on the planet without access to a single mathematical equation regarding fluid dynamics, boundary layer separation, or apparent wind vectors.
They didn't calculate lift.
No, they didn't calculate it. They felt it through the wooden tiller. Long before we had the math to build airplane wings, human beings were intuitively manipulating the exact same aerodynamic forces using woven palm leaves in the middle of the Pacific.
That's unbelievable.
We had essentially mastered the physics of horizontal flight thousands of years before we ever left the ground. So the next time you step outside and feel a sudden gust of wind, I want you to consider what other invisible forces or natural currents might exist in your own life.
Oh, I love that.
Right. Think about whether you might be fighting against them unnecessarily and whether you might be able to harness them just by adjusting your own sails.